You get started at like 6 with your first rounds of Home Depot runs, and then shooting is usually started by 8:30 or 9, and you don't finish shooting until like 7 or 8. And then at the end of the day, you have your back end Home Depot runs. And then in between all of that, you're actually still supposed to be finishing
and like managing like 6 projects right. at the same time.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Repeat on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Now and then, we pull together a podcast interview that probably on paper really shouldn't have happened. Logistically, guest-wise, whatever the reason. And those are really, really satisfying. And this week is definitely one of those weeks where, you know, theoretically, this probably should not have worked out. But it did. People acted fast. We were opportunistic. And I got to have an incredible conversation and visit with two folks from a walk of life that I probably wouldn't typically brush shoulders with, but it ended up being super, super fun and I learned a ton. So basically what happened is I was in Bentonville, Arkansas for this big film project and I started driving home Saturday, finished the drive Sunday evening, and then Monday we hopped on a flight, Nicole and I, to Michigan to deal with a family thing. And as we were headed over, Nicole said, hey, by the way, we're flying into Detroit and this friend that we have has some mutual friends who are stars of an HGTV TV show called Bargain Block, flipping houses in Detroit. Do you want me to hit them up? And I said, yeah, of course. When would you be expecting to record the podcast? And she said, well, I guess tomorrow, because tomorrow's going to be the only day we're in Detroit. So I quickly threw three mics, three XLR cables, and the recorder in my bag, and literally actually my carry-on because that's the only place I had room. Made a couple calls. HGTV reached out because they have to handle everything in regards to their TV stars, of course. And hats off to them for being open to this just at the drop of a hat. And 24 hours later, we were in one of the houses that Keith and Evan are currently flipping, also one of the houses that they're currently living in one of the suburbs of Detroit that's on the rebound. And I kind of had to pinch myself because it was hard to believe that it all came together. But this was one of my favorite conversations on the podcast in quite some time. I hope y'all really enjoy it too. Keith and Evan are absolutely awesome people. And I'm so grateful that they were willing to carve out a little bit of the time out of their unbelievably challenging schedules, full schedules, as you'll hear in this episode. Thank you so much to Zip for being the sponsor of this episode. Zip has an all new wheel. It's called the 353 NSW. You've heard me talk about it on a couple of previous episodes. It is absolutely insane. This is hands down the coolest, most innovative wheel I've ever ridden. It's got that really distinctive sawtooth pattern that you may have seen on some Zip NSW wheels in the past. And that's not just for looks. It improves aerodynamics, particularly in crosswinds. It also allows Zip to make the wheel a lot lighter. This wheel is barely over 1,200 grams, which is totally insane for a wheel that's got a 45 millimeter rim depth. Speaking of that sawtooth pattern also in the crosswind, I'm not exactly 100% on the physics, to be honest. In the wind tunnel, through a lot of testing, Zip has determined that this pattern really makes for greater stability in crosswind. It's one thing for that to be proven in the wind tunnel, but I was out on the open road and I felt it. I was riding in a pretty heavy crosswind and I was literally able to take my hands off the bars, which is crazy because for anyone who's ridden a deeper rim depth rim in crosswind, you'll know you're pretty used to like death gripping, white knuckling the handlebars. So being able to take my hands off the bars was totally insane. Another really cool aspect of this wheel is that it has hookless rims, which means the internal rim width is really wide, 25 millimeters internal. That's great for setting up tubeless. It's also great for aerodynamics, and it allows you to just run lower tire pressure, which means faster rolling, better grip, all the things we like to hear. So go check it out, the new Zip 353 NSW wheel. I'm going to be riding and racing this thing like crazy all of this year. Go check it out. I think you'll be really impressed. Thank you all so much for listening, and I will catch you at the end of the show.
So just a quick lead in for folks. I love, one of my favorite things about podcasting is when something comes together unbelievably last minute and on paper it really shouldn't, and then it does. And it ends up being an awesome opportunity. So just for background, we were in Durango, Colorado yesterday. I had just driven in from Arkansas, same day. And Nicole said, we're going to Detroit. Eddie has these friends who you might be interested in doing a podcast with. Do you want me to give them a call? And we're literally running around trying to pack. And I was like, sure, I guess. And y'all were super responsive. And now, 24 hours later? Is that right? 24 hours later, we're here. That's on fun. The other side of the country. So I love it when that sort of thing happens. So anyway, Keith, Evan, who are you guys? Why are we, why should the world care about what you're doing and who you are?
Well, I don't know why they should care, but
what a fascinating way to start a question. I would say it's our passion for the art and design and the construction that has made what we're doing stand out a little bit. So we're flipping houses in Detroit, obviously abandoned houses. And our goal was to just, you know, kind of start and do these casually. And then it turned into, you know, something that was a lot bigger, and it kept growing and growing. And it was, we talk about this a lot where it's so weird where we're sitting today. It's like, it was clearly laid out way ahead of time. Like, there's no way that all these things come together as beautifully as they have to happen that way. I mean, it's just, we've talked about this path. It was like predetermined almost. It was weird. So every time we had some kind of massive obstacle come up, it was like something would save us. And, you know, sometimes it was us that saved us. Sometimes it was other people. It was friends. It was whatever, but it was weird. And then you get here and you're sitting with a TV show, and you look back and you're like, oh my God, that was wild. But yeah, I hope that the TV show kind of like resonates with people, that you can follow a dream and do something wild and, you know, be successful at it. So
yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah. And just for background, so basically y'all are the stars of an HGTV TV show called Block Bargains.
Bargain Block.
I watched one episode.
Nice.
Full disclosure, I don't, we don't,
there's
have
only been two, so
we don't have TV, so
we don't,
this
have
is new to me,
cable either, so we can't really watch.
Do you do show. You watch your own show?
We had to buy our own show off of Amazon.
We don't have cable.
That's incredible.
It's like we have like Netflix and Amazon, that's it. Like every other person our age, like that's what's been so frustrating. It's like all of our friends want to see the show, and they're like, how can we see it? I'm like, well, you have to have cable. And they're like, oh, well, shit. So like everybody's like, I guess I'll go to my parents' house and watch it. Like, yeah, do that. They have cable.
One of my questions was going to be the some of the financial aspects of being on a network TV show like this. Uh-huh. But the fact that you had to buy off of Amazon the rights to watch your own show might start to answer my question. I'm sure not. But
there's not a lot offered for a season one.
No. Cool. So you're sort of this dynamic duo. I know you each have strengths. That's one thing that I picked up on the first episode I watched. Keith, I take it you're more of the artistic mind. Evan, you're more of the hands-on structural side of things. Is that fair to say?
Yep. Keith is the creative type. I'm the analytical, project managing, you know, keep to the budget type. So those are kind of our roles.
Right, right. And how did this partnership, because I know you're life partners as well, but you're also business partners, which mm-hmm. is an interesting, you know, that there's a whole other series of conversations we could have about that balance. But how did all of this come about? How did y'all decide that this was a thing you wanted to get into? And did it start in Detroit?
No, so it actually started in Colorado. We were living in Idaho Springs, and I was still in graduate school, and Keith actually had a job as a manager at a furniture store. Mm-hmm. And so we both had full-time jobs. We bought a house together. It was kind of like a fixer, and over like 9 months, we fixed it up. And then a little while later, Keith decided that he wanted to buy another house. even higher up.
11,000 feet. Like, I love.
And so he actually quit his job to work on that house full time. I was still going to school, so I would just help out on like the weekends. And that was a whole like crazy adventure. Just getting through that project. But then at some point after I graduated, it kind of came down to, do I want to use my degree and try and find some like industry job, or do I want to go with Keith and do this other thing? And so I was like, well, maybe I'll do industry. So I did like one interview and like, that's it. And then I was like, actually, I'll just go with Keith. So,
well, I'm sorry, what was the degree in?
Physics.
Physics. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where the science comes in. Uh-huh. And was that a hard, you make it sound like it wasn't a hard decision, but when you have a huge amount of time invested and obviously money too, mm-hmm. for what you perceive is going to be your future, was just saying nah to that and following a completely different route, was that a hard decision?
The decision wasn't made super quickly. It was like kind of, I was sort of like just sitting on that choice for like a few months because I was approaching the end. I was working really hard on my dissertation and getting that finished. But then it just sort of like, I don't know, at the time at least, it just seemed more fun just to do this other thing. I don't know if that's entirely it panned out to be accurate, but it was seemed like it was a fun adventure, I guess. And it was also seemed like the kind of like, in a weird way, sort of like the easy path. I was sort of being like lazy. It's like, well, I could like spam my resume to like 100 companies and like go through a million job interviews and like try really hard to get this job, or I could just have this other job and just start doing that. Keith is very he's very persuasive, so
I can be very persuasive.
He promised me that the first house was really nice and livable, and it was not, but
to be fair, I didn't lie, I just didn't know. But I thought I knew, but I didn't know. So yeah.
So Keith, in terms of developing, it sounds like you led the way a little bit in terms of the idea of all this, like you were the first one to kind of take the step down this path. Did you have any background in this sort of work?
My parents, every summer we would renovate a room or add on to the house, and I really kind of fell in love with construction at a very young age. I loved it. It was always, I now realize through some therapy that there was other things that were going on there that I didn't understand. But so like, I was exposed to it, but it was never, you know, like a career path or something, you know, really other than just a hobby. And so I just loved doing it. And I figured, you know, Colorado was the flip market was awesome at the time. It still is great, but I figured we could do something different. And our approach to the houses, even back then, was to get them nice and then also style them really well and try to get attention from the listing photos. If you look at Zillow, you know, all your pictures of the pretty houses that get the big attention have beautiful photos. And so we really kind of like leaned into that as the design.
And it's really the only part that Keith actually enjoys.
It is true. So it'd be kind of like... To be fair, I love the construction. I really do. I love doing construction. I do. If it doesn't linger, you know, like if about 2 days of drywall and I'm done. But if it's longer than that, then, you know, we need to get somebody else in here to do that because that's not fun. But I like doing a lot of it, and it kind of grew up doing that. So, but the design is my jam. I love it. It is what I wake up and live and breathe every day. I love every aspect of it. So I always have. It was really kind of like what put us apart in Denver was these houses were so ridiculously staged because it was like just...
Because Keith just thought it was fun.
I know. The realtor was like... I remember her talking about the staging at one point on one of the houses or the second house, and she was like, you don't have to stage like every room. And I was like, what? Why? No. I'm staging every room. Like... All 5 bedrooms, all 3 bathrooms, all 4 living spaces was like, not just stage, but like heavy stage, like really crazy, over the top. And it was just because I loved it. So moving here, it really kind of stemmed from the fact that we were so limited in Colorado to our volume. We couldn't do, you know, more than 1 or 2 a year because the buy-in was so expensive. The renovation costs were so much more expensive. So I had been looking for a long, long time trying to figure out maybe a better market for doing flips and
at the time, the reason I was in Denver to begin with was the market was really strong. But Detroit kept popping up, and I was following this guy on Instagram, which weirdly enough, he is like disappeared. I have no idea who this person was now. But he flew to Detroit. I remember a story on his Instagram, and he was like headed to Detroit on a red eye. He looked at a bunch of houses. He bought 10 houses and he flipped them all. And so I kind of followed his process along the way for like, I remember it was like a year. And at the end, he sold them all and he did really well. And I was just like, holy shit. So that really put it on the you know, map for me. And then so I just kind of started watching, and just obviously I was really paying attention to price per square foot and location. All of that really kind of factored in. But when I came here, I took a red eye, kind of like this guy, and I had 10 houses lined up, and I got like an hour of sleep at night. It was just awful. It was really cold that day too. And the realtor that I had contacted like brought me in to Detroit from the northern burbs. So if you're familiar with Detroit, or if you look at a map, you'll see that 8 Mile goes like really nice and flat across the northern end of Detroit, right? And so for a person that had never been here or seen, you know, Michigan or anything about it, I was like, great, like, this is amazing. Like, I don't understand why these houses are so cheap. Like, these neighborhoods are fabulous. And so I came in through Ferndale, right? And I was like, oh, this is so crazy. Like, you pass the street. I was like, oh, these are so cute. Like, these houses are amazing. And what you don't realize until you get here is that 8 Mile dividing line is, like, essentially a nowadays, like, red line. It is insane. You cross it, and you have $200 a square foot, and you go south of it, and you're talking about $20 a square foot. And I can... Not now. Yeah. We've helped a little bit. But at least in that particular neighborhood. That's ridiculous. And so... you know, having no knowledge of that, I was sitting there looking at this map on Zillow, and I'm like, holy crap, like, you can buy a $20,000 house.
Right, yeah, he was doing his normal way of looking at comps.
Right.
And then, so it's like, well, it's like literally two blocks away, so right. Like, good, but
I see what you're
not
saying.
Good, because totally. The appraisal would never use those
no.
for the comps.
So like in most urban areas, right, you have lots of little adjoining neighborhoods and cities that make up a metropolitan area. 99% of the time across the board, when people are pulling, when a appraiser is pulling comps, even if it's across, you know, a city marker line or anything like that, generally speaking, in the city of Denver, it was our main experience, everything was consistent. So they could use a comp from like Littleton for...
Well, I mean, if it's, you know, like two blocks away, it's, I mean, that's, right. That's nothing, right?
Yeah.
Like,
well, you're supposed to, you know, they usually say that they pull within a, you know, a half mile to a mile radius, right? Well, in Detroit, that's not the case. You get...
it's like almost block by block.
It is block by block by block. And it's really insane to see. You can have a house just a couple of blocks away, maybe even one block. We've seen one block difference where you'll have a nice appraisal. We'll get our appraisal back. And it's like, whoa. Like, the most jarring one was we had a street on the west side, a house on the block next to it. It was literally catty corner on the block, sold for $130,000, which for Detroit, that's a pretty nice house, right? So we had the house literally, you could have walked to it in less than a minute. And so I figured that was a strong comp. We got our comp back and it was half, and it was a block away. And we're just like, what is going on? The price per square foot was half of what the other house was. And it was just like, it wasn't computing. And so some of these neighborhoods that we work in, we see this repeatedly. And it's part of the reason that this became like a passion project. You get so mad because you're like, this is injustice. You know, this is not fair. The people that live in the city of Detroit should be able to use a comp from a surrounding neighborhood, just like anywhere else in the metro, you know, layouts of the U.S. It just really bugs me.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, we did a little bit of reading last night and just reading into the history of the prejudice that happened in regards to, you know, mortgage advantages that mm-hmm. were given to, you know, white people that weren't necessarily extended to black people. Mm-mm. And it's really incredible what sort of, you know, just boundaries that created. And right. It seems like what you're describing is very much related to that, yeah. I would have to assume. And
yeah, I mean, in this price range, you just don't have buyers who have cash, right? They don't have like stockpiles of cash. I mean, if you're selling a house for $85,000, who's going to have 20 grand? Like, that's right. Like a quarter of the house
right.
price, right? And so, and that's what's needed to increase comps, right? So like you have the appraiser come in and they say, well, this house sold for this, but you might have an offer for that's like higher, but the appraiser nicks that. And then you just have to go with the lower offer because the buyer doesn't have cash. So then,
first-time home buyers usually don't have a lot of extra cash.
Yeah. So then that bottlenecks the price per square foot in the neighborhood. It just like caps and just never goes any higher because no buyer has the required cash to actually push it. So in our first neighborhood, we had a few buyers who came in who actually had some cash. They were able to like hit up
gradually
like their parents or something for like a little bit extra cash. So then that neighborhood has gone up. But I mean, it takes those people who have those piles of cash to actually mm-hmm. increase the value. And it's not like we're trying to like go crazy, but mm-hmm. it's like,
I mean, but it has such a ripple effect when you aren't able to get an appraisal. The people that have owned homes in the city for decades,
their home is like valueless.
It's valueless
because some appraiser says it's valueless, right?
But that's not fair because it's still a real estate, you know, it's a piece of real estate. It should be as valuable as a house across a road. Like, I don't understand. And I mean, I just cannot fathom how that can be looked at as fair. And then you have the ripple effects of most people's biggest investment, their biggest piece of value that they own is their home. And so, you know, for the generational wealth, it's a massive hit to that. Like, you're passing on a house that if it was across a road is worth
three times more,
or you know, yeah. in some cases 10 times more, and you can literally cross a street. Like, I think of the east side of Detroit when you get into the Grosse Pointe area, those borders are even more extreme. So, you know, it's just absolutely insane to say just because you live in this zip code, your house is worth, you know,
basically nothing.
Yeah. And you can't pass that on generationally. We're of a, you know, we have family that would be passing on a house of value, right, when they pass. And in this city, that is not the case for the most part. And it's really...
Well, then they pass it on, but it's just not a valuable asset, yeah. You know.
And it's, you know, it's a really unfair thing. So,
yeah.
It just makes me mad.
Well, I mean, clearly, it's cool to hear that there's real passion here. In a realm that goes far beyond just the financial. Like, y'all aren't here just for financial opportunity. I mean, obviously that's a big part of what you're doing, but there's this other aspect. Nicole and I were talking about this in the car a little bit. There's this other aspect of, you know, Detroit's life story mm-hmm. as a city is really unique.
Right.
And it's on the rebound, but it clearly has a long way to go still, like y'all are describing. For people who have totally been living under a rock, let's just quickly do a little rehash of Detroit's history. So obviously it's the Motor City. For a long, long time, vehicles were pretty much not the single, but by far and away the greatest industry here. Mm-hmm. And then was it around the 60s, 70s that started to fall apart?
Mm-hmm.
And then there was just this massive decline. And I think it was 2013 that the city itself announced bankruptcy, mm-hmm. largest in history for mm-hmm. a municipality, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's why there's all of this home flipping opportunity for y'all, mm-hmm. I take it. So I guess from your perspective, I would like to hear a little bit more about what it's like to live in this city, mm-hmm. you know, big picture. What are some, other than the observations you just provided, you know, culturally, things you appreciate, things you're, you know, looking forward to improving, you know, whatever it may be, any observations, big picture about Detroit, the city?
The city to us.
Well, I mean, I the thing that's most noticeable to me is how much has changed in just like the 3.5 years that we've been here.
Mm-hmm.
When we first moved here in 2017, we would go down to, what's that little square where Etoria is? What's that called?
Columbus Square.
Yeah, there's this little like square that's like super cute now. But when we moved there, there was literally, it's surrounded by essentially skyscrapers that were boarded up.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like luxury lofts with mm-hmm. like really cute, like Thai restaurants and like mm-hmm. these like, you know, very like fun things. And it's completely full. Nothing's boarded up. And like that to me is just like a perfect example of like how much it's changed in just mm-hmm. the 3.5 years that we've been here.
What's not changing though is, it's great to see the money pouring into the downtown core. What's the money's pouring into Midtown, but a lot of the neighborhoods that are these fringe neighborhoods that are kind of in some cases on the verge of collapse, you don't see investment in that. You don't
right.
see.
I mean, and part of the reason is because investors don't see an opportunity to make money, mm-hmm. right? And that goes again to the comps and like the values. Right. Like you just can't. It's hard to make money. Right. So
no, we are
stay away from it.
Our margins are very lean because, you know, we might even on the show on the, you know, there's things that are factored in that, you know, don't necessarily show up on that. But like appraisal gaps, we will get a $99,000 offer and then the appraisal comes in at 75. And so you're sitting there and you have no argument. So, you know, you get these great offers and it looks beautiful and it's all wonderful. And then the reality is you have a mortgage company that is essentially, you know, bullying Detroit again. And because of your location, you can't get people to invest if there's no margins. You know, like we're in a capitalistic society. Obviously, you have to make money. And if you don't have a way to do that, if you can't provide enough incentive for, you know, that type of development, especially on these fringe neighborhoods, nobody's going to do it. You know, we thought we were going to do better when we came here, you know, just based on what my research was. And then you realize that can't win. So
so what do you like about Detroit?
Oh, sorry.
Why are you still here?
I'm sorry. I'm back mad again about the mortgage industry. No, I love I'm sorry. Yeah. No, that's bad. I'm really bad at tangents. I love what is going on. And don't get me wrong, I'm very grateful for every penny that is poured down or poured into the city, no matter how it comes about. But I just would like to remind everybody that, you know, there are neighborhoods outside of the popular trendy places, you know, and I love those neighborhoods more. You get the more authentic version of Detroit. You get the kindness, you get the people that will help you no matter what. You get the best food you can ever imagine from neighbors. And it is just, that is Detroit to me. Like the downtown, I love it. I love the change, yay. But it's the people. Oh my God. Like I love these people.
What are the jobs that are coming back?
There's a lot of AI with self-driving.
Quicken kind of, I think, I mean, Quicken. I'm by no means a historian of this city, but from my understanding, Quicken had like a big part in bringing at least the downtown core back.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they came in and like sort of
they invested
bought
a
whole bunch of buildings and invested a ton of money and mm-hmm. move their whole operation down there so that people were like sort of forced to like go there every day.
Right.
And then that sort of naturally helped change it. But
mm-hmm. We have a few Airbnbs and I would say 80% of our guests that stay are in the medical field. There's like a really strong
there's like
medical
that,
presence here.
Yeah, that so. Wayne State medical mm-hmm. Facility that's downtown.
The medical is, you know, it's we see it as kind of holding some of the neighborhoods together in the best ways because, you know, like there's a hospital not too far from where we live south of here that has kind of like held the whole place together, kind of like what Wayne State did with their security.
Midtown, yeah.
In Midtown, they like started to patrol when the city went into bankruptcy, that area, and that was kind of where people started to come back. And you see those little pockets popping up around the whole city, so that was, you know, that's always nice to see that kind of stuff. But yeah, the jobs here, we talk to a ton of engineers every day. We talk to a ton of nurses and a lot of doctors. But yeah, Detroit has positioned itself to bring in a nice amount of high-end, high-paying jobs. And I think, you know, we see the momentum building there a lot. The Ford train depot downtown, like seeing that start to get renovated.
Yeah, I think it's going to be like their
AI.
They're like self-driving, like headquarters or something, yeah. Or something like that.
Yeah, it's clear that this is still very much a car,
yes.
You know,
yes.
Capital of the world. I mean, just on a drive over here, I saw the new Ford Bronco, not the sport. The sports around are all over the place, but the off-road Ford Bronco. Uh-huh. That was the first time I saw one in person. Mm-hmm. And then also there was some
my dream
Jeep car. With the Ford Bronco.
Uh-huh.
I put a deposit in on one, believe it or not.
Nice.
She's shaking her head.
I love it.
When I saw it driving on the road, I was like, yeah, I'm going to buy that.
My dad had a Bronco, and I love that.
My dad.
Do you want an older one? Or
I would love an older one. Yeah. But I'll take a new one, too. Those things will go up a wall. That's like, I loved it.
But anyway, and then we saw some crazy-looking Jeep that had the wild wrap on it to make the contours, you know, not as familiar. So clearly there's a lot of vehicle stuff going on here still, but
it's fun to see all those like prototype cars too that they're driving around. I'm like, the first time I saw one wrapped in it, I was like, oh my god, what, why would you do that to your car? And then somebody told me it was a concept car or whatever, and I was like, oh okay, had no idea. It's like, that is the gaudiest car I've ever seen. A little bit.
Well, so let's talk about how the TV show opportunity came about.
So back in the day,
long winding road to end up here.
In Colorado, I had this really fun friend who, she called me one day out of the blue. I had been building tiny houses in Texas and then started building them in Colorado and was doing vintage campers there, and really loved doing tiny houses. It's like my favorite shit. And so this friend of mine called, and she was like, hey, I saw a casting call. Like, she wanted to be on TV. She was really funny. And she called and she was like, I saw a casting call for a tiny house. Like, we should do this. So I was like, all right, cool, I'm in. And that was easy. She was like, I was like, done. So we bought a trailer the next week, and we built this tiny house for a show called Tiny Paradise. And it was a really nicely rated episode. It was a really cute, you know, finish out. It went really well. The shooting was kind of chaotic, but that was the first time. But that got me in kind of like
talks different, you know, production companies.
And then so we went under contract with a production company out of Denver who pitched a show that later actually went on to be, it's now on Netflix, but it didn't go anywhere.
It was one of those things where, I mean, it's the same concept, but it wasn't pitched by the same company.
Same concept, but different company. But we got pitched for this other show, and it went nowhere. So at that point, he was about to graduate, so I was like, I'm done. Like, the TV thing was kind of, I thought I was over with it. And then, so anyway, this other girl in Denver that I love, she called one day, and she worked for High Noon, which is the production company that we signed with, obviously, for this. But she was like, I saw your Tiny Paradise episode, loved it. Like, we would love to chat with you. And I was like, I'm done. Like, I don't really feel like that. We're moving to Detroit. Like, there's nothing to film. You know, I had no idea really what we would be doing here.
And we were just kind of like that sounds kind of annoying.
Like, yeah, I was like, I don't want to, no, just like, there was no like concept really at that point because we were in this mid-ground, this transitional period. So anyway, we came out to Detroit and bought that first house. It was a complete disaster. I thought it was like this really great house. I thought it would be super easy, and it was just, it was a nightmare.
Well, I mean, still is a lot. I mean, we did kind of luck out because we have since seen houses that are far worse.
Way worse.
But we kind of lucked out. It was like an easy in, but still definitely not what you're used to in Colorado by any means.
No. So we got that house flipped. We put it on the market. It was heavily designed, and, you know, we didn't live there terribly long, but we really kind of did it up. And this guy that was writing for Curbed magazine saw our listing on Zillow, and he was, at the time, he would write up like little stories about cute properties in the city that were for, you know, like for sale. And so he did that house, and it went really well, and we got a nice offer, and the appraisal hit us really hard, but whatever. We sold the house and we moved. And then so the second house, I was posting all of this kind of to Instagram, and this guy that turned out to be like, he's an amazing guy, but he was watching all of this, and he worked for High Noon, and he kind of came up with this concept of like, we're living in the houses, we renovate them. I mean,
it's basically just like based off of our life. It was based off like at that time.
But he was very persistent, and we kept ignoring him. He kept like calling, and he was like,
we probably ignored him for like 6 months or something.
Yeah, at least. Poor Danny. He was so patient. But he kept like calling about every week and a half or so. He would call. He was like, hey, just like, I can send you a list of like pictures and videos to do, and we can put this thing together. I'm like, oh no. Ugh. And we just finally, I just like ignored him completely. I just stopped responding. And I don't remember how it played out after that, but he finally got a hold of us, and he was like, just do this. And we were like, all right. Like, fine. So Evan did a couple of videos.
Basically sent like a shot list and an email. It was like 20 shots that we just wanted us to film on our iPhone. And so we did it. And then we sent them off. And then it was a super long, it was like, I don't know.
What? Felt like an
like
eternity.
6 months, 8 months.
I forgot about them again.
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then we find out that the network actually loved it and they wanted to do a pilot based off of what's called the sizzle. That it was like a little 3 or 4 minute, like essentially like a trailer.
Right.
And we had never seen it.
We did see it later.
We saw it later really, and it was amazing. Like he did.
I don't know how he did that.
It was like literally like these like shitty iPhone, like
I know
these shitty iPhone videos that they just like edited together. And it was like, I want to watch that show.
I was amazing. Like, I was like, who are these guys? This is the greatest show ever. I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And I remember just being so struck by that. I was like, it is amazing what one person with a tiny bit of vision on the TV side, because we kind of had the vision for the business ish, but he saw something I think even that we really didn't see.
Well, it's amazing what editing does.
It is amazing. Yeah.
Insane.
But anyway, then they called after that. When they called to tell us that we were going to do a pilot, I was in full drag at a Halloween party. I was dressed as the White Witch from, I was Tilda Swinton. And, they were like, I think Karina was like, do you want to FaceTime? I was like, well, I'm in like full regalia and I don't know. So that's always a fun memory. It's like when I found out they were going to do a pilot, I was like living my best life. There's a gift from that night. It was hilarious. But anyway, and then, yeah, so we did the pilot. That was the most stressful thing I think I've ever been
up until that point. That had been.
Yeah.
I mean, to this point, I still think it was the most amount of physical work we've ever had to do in our entire life.
We flipped two houses in 6 weeks.
Yeah, and it was,
and
what? Yeah. It was on our own.
On our own. We had like
very little help.
Three people that were helping us. Phil was with us full time.
Two people really.
Yeah.
And how frustrating was it to have a film crew around for that whole process when you're trying to do the?
So they were actually the way that they filmed it to save
the
money.
The pilot was easy.
Yeah, because they would only show up for like 2 days a week.
Yeah,
and we would have to get all of our scene work in those 2 days. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, we were like busting our ass to like actually get the houses done, and then we would like have short little scenes of like drywall scenes and like mudding scenes and painting scenes and whatever. So that, I mean, it wasn't as intrusive as the season would be when you actually get the season, but it was just the work level was just absolutely insane.
Up like, to that point, we'd only flipped three full houses, and technically the third one wasn't really finished.
Well, one, two, three, and then like five probably if you count Colorado.
Okay, well, in our time here, we hadn't done very
Keith
many.
Had always done stuff back in Texas, but like together, well, we had done like five
over the course of like 4 years, and then now we're doing two in 6 weeks, and it was like we were just kind of I think it was one of those things where you kind of get in that mode and you're like, well, at least for me, I was like, well, there is no failing. I'm not going to get sued over this. Well, which I didn't know that they wouldn't actually sue me if I didn't meet the deadline. But I was like, this is very serious. We're going to get through this. It was really hard. We were like doing 18, 20 hour days every day for 7 days a week. And Evan, at one point, we had a paint scene. And the house hadn't been mudded. So the day before...
We still hadn't finished mudding, and we were scheduled to do the paint scene. So the mudding had to get done. Mm-hmm. And it was... This is in, like, April. So April in Detroit is super cold and wet.
Yeah.
And not this year, but typically it is. And so trying to get mud to dry in an unheated house is, like, a nightmare. So we had all these propane heaters, and it was probably, like... So if you've ever been in like a sauna and looked at the temp, like when you see like 140, like 160, that's literally what it felt like. Mm-hmm. And we're
in there for hours.
For hours on
end. I did fine actually, but...
And I was doing the ceiling, so I was 8 feet up, and it's probably like 20 degrees hotter if you're like... And I was up there for hours, and I got home. We like got done at like midnight or something, so I came home, and suddenly like sat down, and I just started like shivering. I was like, why am I so cold? And then I think I had heat stroke.
Yeah, it was
that
bad.
Knocked me out for like 2 days. And Keith
he
had
was
like,
violently ill for like 2 days.
Like, it was bizarre how sick I was.
It was wild.
And then so then Keith had to like work by himself while I was like puking every 5 minutes for like 2 days.
It was awful.
And then, yeah.
We got through it, though. And, yeah, the houses looked great at the end. Nobody died.
we did it in 6 weeks.
We did meet our deadline. And after that, it was kind of like, all right, well, shit. We can do it, you know?
Did you know that you'd have more time?
No.
Future episodes. Or did you think it would be that sort of work?
I knew that it would be a little worse. Well, it was a little bit different situation, but
if you do the math, it was worse. 16 houses in what, 30 weeks?
30 weeks, yeah.
That doesn't even make sense.
But we had more help.
We did have more help. But a little more help. But yeah, it was wild. I mean, you see these TV shows, and I think a lot of people are like, oh, they don't do the work. And we didn't do 100% of the work, but we did a shocking amount of the work. A, we didn't have the money because, you know, these houses don't provide enough margins, blah, 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 back to that. So, you know, the TV show was definitely, there were definitely moments where you're standing there and you wake up in the morning and you're like, how the fuck did my life get to this? Like, how am I here right now?
Well, yeah, let's talk about the numbers quickly, just to give some context for people. 'Cause watching the, I think it was the pilot that I watched. The numbers were pretty shocking. So when you say you're coming here and you're gonna just buy 10 houses to flip, can you put some numbers to that? Like, what's it like here in Detroit? The houses that y'all are buying to flip, how much do they? I know it's all over the map. Right. Yeah. Give us a range.
Yeah. So I mean, it depends where you're buying them from. If it's like a land bank house, which is this institution that's like kind of this public-private thing that the city has, where it's like a bank of houses, and those can go for like $1,000. But if you do like a private
For folks that haven't seen, describe one of these $1,000 houses.
I mean,
barely standing.
Yeah. Like complete wreck.
Yeah.
Like,
there's not a lot of interior anything left. Most of the houses have been stripped of all copper, all metal wire. There's no,
I mean, you'll have, you know, plumbing missing stacks, back walls. Yeah. Like, I mean,
we've had many houses that don't have a full wall. Like the house we just moved out of, actually, when we bought it, it looked normal. Like, it looked like a wall, but I was standing there.
But you could like push it over.
And like the whole wall just kind of crumbled as I pushed on it. I was just like, oh, fuck.
So why not? Why? Because a lot of people would just say they're buying the lot and they just flatten it, use the foundation, build something new. So what's the advantage?
It's still cheaper to flip than it is to build new. Because, I mean, you're not, it's still cheaper. I mean,
there's still some salvageable things.
Like,
things.
You might have a back wall that's like missing, but the rest of like the,
the foundation's there.
Yeah. The rest of the framing is usually fine.
Yeah.
You might have to like sister some joists and stuff like that, but.
And it's just so. It's,
yeah, it would be more expensive to raise it.
Yeah.
Roof, all that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of it is, most of a house is salvageable. You know, you can really do a lot if you know how to kind of like dissect it and put it back together. So it saves a lot of money compared to building new. Plus, building new in the city right now, it's really difficult to be able to justify the cost of new construction, especially with everything that's going on. Like, lumber costs right now are unbelievable. So any lumber that is saved on a house partially standing is that much.
Like, the price per square foot still isn't quite high enough to just, I mean, it is in some areas. Like the Midtown area, it is, but in the neighborhoods that we're working in, it doesn't really justify it.
So let's talk about the actual process of shooting the TV show and what that's like. So you obviously, like most TV shows, there's seasons. What does that time frame look like? How are your lives different? How long does the filming process take? Is it annoying?
Well, you have no life.
You have no life.
Your life is completely consumed.
Yeah.
By
filming. It was something that
it ended up being like 30 weeks of shooting,
and that was
season
with
one, which is like
most of the year,
pretty long, I think, for most HG shows. Like, I know some others that I think were like 12 weeks, 15 weeks.
Yeah,
I think that's,
it was the
more
biggest
difficult
season one in terms of volume. We were told like the most number of houses for a season one, and then also we're the first show to do two flips per episode. So
at least I think. I mean,
that's like a new concept we were told. Yeah. I mean, maybe somewhere else, I don't know. But the whole, you know, like hook of the show is that we're doing two houses. Sometimes we have three reveals because we even filmed some of the houses that we didn't show construction on, but there's just a lot of house stuff in there.
I think the total there's
22
reveals in the season.
Yeah.
Holy
and then and,
how know, many episodes?
Nine
total.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it was just, I mean, people would text us, and I still haven't responded to all my texts from the show, but you get started at like 6 with your first rounds of Home Depot runs, and then shooting is usually started by 8:30 or 9, and you don't finish shooting until like 7 or 8, and then at the end of the day you have your back end Home Depot runs. And then in between all of that, you're actually still supposed to be finishing
managing like 6 projects at the same time.
At any time at the height of it, we were running 8 houses kind of in different phases, but at once there were 8 different houses. Plus we were taking on client work to be able to pay for all of this shit. So we were literally working like, I mean, I don't think people believe us when we tell them at the amount of time that was put into this is just like staggering. But it was kind of, there were days that, you know, you asked if it was annoying. I just really wanted to reach out and grab somebody.
Can you say that again?
We won't go any further. But
yeah,
it was. There were days. It was definitely. I mean, it's just like the stress level is so high, just like constantly. It's like this constant.
Sounds really familiar. So like, I just got off a shoot last week, and Nicole wasn't there, but even through the phone, like it got pretty tough at times, just from a relationship standpoint, because it is 100% consuming. And what I do isn't nearly to the level y'all do. I just can't imagine.
I mean, you get to a point where it's just like the stress is so constant and at such a high level that, I mean, I guess your body just starts to get like kind of numb to it because it's just like...
Yeah. And then you reached, or at least I felt kind of like during about halfway, when COVID happened and then everything shut down, I think in the last year, like every anxiety that you could possibly have just broke. It was just like, we've faced, his dad died, my grandfather died, the COVID shut down, the TV show being going, like constantly running out of money because it takes on average like 97 days to close a house in Detroit versus 36 in the suburbs. So our cash flow model was dependent on selling these houses. So we're waiting in some, and 97 days was actually, that's the average. So we, yeah, in some cases, some
that are like 140.
Yeah. Shocking amounts of time to close a house. So we're sitting there and we're just like, all right, well, we have like $12 today, so we can do a paint scene. That's like it. And the production company is like, why are we behind schedule? I'm like, well, I think one time I screenshotted a picture of our bank account at one point, and I was like, all three of them had like 48 cents combined. And it was just like, we're waiting for something. We're waiting to happen. For
like 2 houses to close. Yeah. There's still like, just, don't ask me when it's going to close. I don't know.
I would
like,
wake up in the middle of the night just sweating. And I was just like sitting there panicking. I was like, we have all these people depending on us for a job because you have a camera crew that if you cancel, all these people lose their job for the day. It's gig work, you know, it's contracted out. You have all of our employees that if we wake up one day and we're like, I'm not really feeling it today. Like 25 people aren't working that day just because we are being lazy. So this pressure just is immense. And then you get the TV side where they're like, bigger, bigger energy. Like we need you bigger, like more. It's like, it's hard. So
why are you doing it still?
Oh then, man.
I mean, like at this point, we're just like, I don't even know. Like we just have we have this. It's just like, this is now our path. Like, this is happening, and so we'll see where this goes.
We stopped fighting it a while back, I feel like, so much, because we finally realized that it didn't matter what we did. It was already, like, we were just in this swept away river.
In this current of that was just taking us somewhere, and I'm just like, paddle harder.
You kind of have to just, like, let go and just be okay with the chaos and the stress, and you realize one day that it's like,
and it's fine, and it's over.
Our house got broken into today, and I'm able to laugh about that, you know, or, you know, like we had a house fire, or, you know, our employee wrecked both of our cars one day, and it was just like, oh, okay, this is, you know, this is life.
Okay, let's quick time out. We need to talk about home break-ins, fires, and cars getting wrecked.
The fire is not.
We'll leave the fire off limits. Okay. Yeah. The break-ins, you know, it's Detroit. It's actually, somebody once said, is like, is it dangerous or is it crazy living in Detroit? And I was like, actually, I've been broken into in Denver and Texas more than I ever have here. It's happened a few times to us here, but in Texas, oh my goodness.
Wait, it's happened a few times this year?
Yeah.
No, here.
Here, and in the last year,
it's been 3 times. That's how construction sites are. Like, construction sites are just, like, targets.
They're easy.
People aren't breaking into the houses that we're living in. It's it's all, like, construction sites.
Yeah. It's that easy, like, you know, go grab a furnace that's
maybe someone
left.
Like, maybe there's a furnace, or maybe someone left a miter saw. Or like,
yeah, we've had our tools cleaned. That's the only way we really buy new tools is they just get, you know, taken one day. We're like, oh, okay, time for a new saw, I guess.
So... In regards to financial upside, I mean, there's the aspect of the business that theoretically could have great payoff, even though you say margins are pretty thin sometimes. In terms of outlook of your, you know, blossoming TV careers. Do you study other people that have been in your sort of positions on these TV shows and what they've sort of curated or turned that into, parlayed it into?
Sure. I mean, you always look at, you know, at comparisons. And obviously, I mean, I think the whole point of the TV for us is to like, well, maybe we can, because we also have a furniture store. And it's sort of like, I mean, that definitely took a way back seat during filming. But like that is kind of what we were doing before we started filming, is we had this furniture store and we also were flipping houses. Mm-hmm. And so with the TV show, we want to kind of maybe focus, put a little bit more attention on the furniture side, like the brand side, on the lifestyle brand, mm-hmm. and the design side. It seemed like a good opportunity that we could utilize the exposure to, you know, sell our brand and not just sell homes.
I think in the future, I would love to look at taking the actual house flipping and turn it into essentially like a non-profit, because it's really not profitable.
Yeah, that's something that we've been toying with, is that
crowdfunding, or, you know, I don't know exactly how we're going to raise the money to do it right now, but I feel like that would be a much better approach than what we were trying to do, which was essentially like get these investors to believe in what we're doing. We do have a great investment group right now that did believe in our idea. But at the end, you know, we turned around and we didn't make them really any money. Well, none really. But, you know, they were kind enough to get us through that, because I think they also saw the potential for the lifestyle brand that might come along with it. But again, like, we will continue our business of flipping, but it would be better, I think, if we could figure out a way to do it where we're not depending on that as our income, because that puts a lot of stress on it, and it just makes it so that you're really limited in your volume. Like, if we had a big pile of cash from, you know, a nonprofit where we could do as many as we could, that would be awesome, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're looking at partnerships. Our next door neighbor here is he's like a deacon, and they do abandoned house renovations kind of like we do. So we were talking, you know, maybe there's a partnership opportunity there, and just trying to figure out, I guess, really it kind of boiled down to everybody thought that we were out here kind of for the money. And in the beginning, yeah, it was really the money, but then it turned into like a weird passion project. And it was like, A, the design and the art I love, but then B, you actually start to see some benefit when you get past that little tipping point. It's like, oh, there's this renewed energy, you know. So I can see it continuing, but it is a very stressful life
at times.
Have you had any weird or funny encounters out and about with people recognizing you from the TV show?
Not really yet.
We have masks, thank God. But we were walking.
You have what?
Masks.
You know. Oh, gotcha, gotcha. During
wearing a mask.
So I thought you were talking about like wearing a disguise. No. I was like, damn.
I have my Nixon mask. No, we do stand out a bit. We were on the news here in Detroit once, and the next day I went to the grocery store, and everybody in the grocery store recognized me. But I was like, red beard, I kind of do stand out a little bit, and it was just odd, like everybody watches the news here.
how many years of this do you think you have in you?
Well, we have a hard stop. I do.
Like what, 5 seasons or so?
Well,
or something?
Like, my goal, and it sounds stupid, but my goal never was to get a big pile of money. I just wanted like an 80-acre farm in the mountains somewhere with a bunch of goats.
That's his retirement dream.
So like by 40, I really would love either, you know, I feel like we'll always have a house in Detroit because it's just like, it's so cheap. Why would you not? But it'll always be fun to kind of keep our ties here. But eventually, you know, like by 40, I want my quiet life. I know this is going to sound crazy. We were joking about this today, actually. Evan seriously said his whole goal in life was just to draw the least amount of attention to himself as possible. And I was like, you literally have failed at your life goal miserably. You have a national television show. And it's
incredible.
We both are actually we are chatty, but we're both kind of introverts a little bit. Like, I love being home. I don't like going and doing a ton of stuff, but yeah. Anyway,
so I mean, again, it's all just gonna be like, it's gonna be what it's gonna be.
Yeah,
like
we could get horrible ratings tomorrow, we get ratings for today's episode, so if they're just really abysmal, it's like, all right, well, that was fun, we'll just finish out the season airing and then we'll move on with our life, like go back to, you know, just flipping.
What time of day does it play?
9
Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, so you got a pretty good slot.
Yes,
that's fun.
Yes, it was really, so not to brag too much, but we were top 10 last week, and that was pretty exciting for a second episode, I thought. And so, yeah, there's been some really, really positive feedback from the show. You know, we still hear the word gentrification, and that really just, every time I read it on Twitter, I just kind of die a little inside. Like, it hurts me so bad, because if people actually took the time to understand what's going on in Detroit, A, and then B, what we're actually trying to do, they wouldn't use that
Let's talk about that a little bit, actually. So, from the Twitter mafia's perspective, the folks that I call recreationally outraged.
What a great term! I love that. I know.
What is their perspective?
90% of Twitter has been extremely positive, but every now and then you'll hear something about gentrification, and it's hard to look at that, and because when I think of gentrification, I think of displacing people that were living there and essentially pushing people into a place that
different
they don't. Or, you know, anytime that you displace somebody, I don't think that's fair. Like, if it's against their will. I remember in Lubbock once, they did this massive, the city and the developer bought up this massive piece of land, and there was a lot of people that were living in that, and they literally just got pushed out. They were just gone one day, and they raised the entire thing and built, you know, these big high-rise apartments. And so what our approach was with the city of Detroit was to not ever, you know, go into it with trying to, we only want the abandoned houses if we can help it, or the ones that, even if they're private sale, that nobody can live in right now. And if you can pick those out of a neighborhood that's stabilized and you can bring those values up, then it kind of balances everybody else. But I don't ever want to displace anybody. I don't want anybody.
Yeah, to and think. Our goal is not to like turn those neighborhoods into a Ferndale, where like suddenly,
Ferndale's overpriced.
You can't afford a house, right? I mean, so like that's not the goal. It's more just to like bring up the housing prices to a point where it's like appropriate,
right?
Like, at least because before and it fair. Was like shockingly low, and it was like, which I don't think is helpful. But it's also not helpful to have it be shockingly high. So you kind of want to have it to a point where it's very affordable, but also people actually have some value.
And it's a really delicate balance trying to find that. That's why we kind of came up with that $100,000 market. It seemed that it was like, that was a nice area to kind of land in where you...
And you don't, and you're not really pricing out anyone, because actually if you were to rent in those neighborhoods, the rental would be more than your mortgage is for a $100,000 house.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like makes no sense not to just own the home.
Right. Yep. On average, like a $100,000 mortgage is running, and like if we have an example, she's paying like $793 with taxes and insurance included, and she was paying $1,100 in the same neighborhood for rent for a three bedroom. She owns a three bedroom now. She's saving money.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, we've even thankfully been able to do a couple of land contracts. I would love to do more land contracts, because
that's definitely hard for us
though,
because it's,
we don't have
it's such
cash.
A huge cap, we don't have the capital in order to do that,
but a lot of people that come to us looking for houses don't qualify in the traditional mortgage route, right? They don't have the right credit score, and if you look at their credit, it's like, oh, well, you have something from like...
Well, I mean, it's sort of silly, because it's like, well, you're paying $1,000 in rent.
Well, so clearly you can pay
a mortgage. You can afford it.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've done that when we can, and that has been how... And what's really fascinating is our success story with those are shocking. Like, a couple of our people that... One of them literally pays their bills better than I do. Like, always, the day it is due, we get the check, and it is... She's so proud of her house, and I love that. And that is... She was paying so much money for rent before, and she now has $535 payment. Mm-hmm. So it was a really small house. So
that's awesome.
If we could continue to do that kind of stuff, where people are coming in and saying, you know, actually, if you look at a land contract, they're pretty stable, and they have a better return over the long term than even the stock market. But it's an amazing opportunity to kind of get involved hands-free. You know, you don't have to touch a house, but you can provide a mortgage for somebody if you were to take on a project like that. So I don't know. I just see lots of opportunities for the money side, where people could come in and be like, you could make a little bit of money and have something kind of stable, and it does, you know, you're not gonna make a ton, but you don't, I don't think you need to make a ton of money. Nobody should have so much money.
So we have about 15 minutes here until we need to get Evan out the door, but speaking of sort of applying some of this stuff for folks that might be listening, what are, maybe they're homeowners, maybe they're yeah, I guess speaking to homeowners at this point, if someone is interested in upgrading their house or doing some sort of small remodel, because we all know during COVID that got really, really popular. What are some things that y'all might recommend people pay especially close attention to, whether it be the process or even, you know, specific style rooms to focus on if they're looking at raising the value, maybe just little tricks of the trade or things that y'all think about that sort of makes the magic of what you do happen?
Well, if you're looking to sell your house, I mean, people buy houses for kitchens and baths. Like, that's the thing that kind of gives people that awe, right? So if you're looking to sell, if you want to make the highest impact, then I would say focus on those. Although those can be the most expensive rooms to work on.
But there's a lot of hacks you can do. I mean, tile paint. My favorite hack, I think, is tile paint. It is absolutely...
Yeah, like, there's some really nice tile paint products like out there now that are pretty durable.
And you can get any color. I did an ombre once. It was really fun.
What is a tile paint?
It's just a paint that's meant for painting tile. So, yeah, it's just like formulated for tile. And
it dries like essentially to mimic the porcelain finish of, and it holds up like really
super,
well.
Super durable, super hard.
But like those type of things are really, really easy to upgrade. Very cheap
and way to like spice up a room.
Totally. Paint is my number one friend. Like you can do so much with paint. And I bought all my Oops paint. Like it's like $9 for a gallon, $1.20. I went today and bought a bunch of Oops paint because I'm doing some art later. Like the little, you get like a little sampler for $1, a little quart for $3. But you know, I always look at like different paint techniques that you can do, and there's just so many. And if you have a little bit of time and a little bit of patience, you can really knock out some really fun stuff.
And you can always paint your own cabinets.
Yeah.
That can be, I mean, so like as long as you do that labor yourself, it's not super so pricey just for paint. Yeah. So do things like
spend
that.
Spend the money on a nice cabinet paint if you're going to do it.
Yeah, you want to go with a nice paint. You don't want to go cheap.
Yeah.
And then like new hardware for cabinets can...
We just painted these really ugly... You know the white Formica cabinets from the 80s that had that little wood top and bottom? They were like iconic. Even those painted white were like beautiful. We do a lot of concrete countertops. People have called us and I had these... really good friends in Denver, and they were like, we're gonna do our own concrete countertop. I'm like, awesome, check for leaks, because you're supposed to seal everything. And it's the weekend warrior thing, man. Like, I love a challenge, and YouTube has a ton of really great videos for stuff like that. So we use YouTube, even with, we have our builder's license, and we still go to YouTube almost every day when we're working on houses. It's like just a perfect tool. But there's like a million things. The other thing on the exterior, clean your gutters out. Other than that, like, at least out here in the West, like, man, I never cleaned my gutter ever. I didn't even have gutters on my house growing up because it was so dry down in West Texas. It never rained.
Definitely
rain, so.
In Michigan, the number one reason that a house falls apart is that the gutters fail.
Yep.
And then just houses.
It's such a simple thing, too, but nobody cleans their gutters. And I'm guilty of it, too. Hate it. It's not fun. Every now and then I'll get up there and, like, slop out all the grossness, but it's, like, the number one way to avoid, like, 90% of the problems with the house here. So.
Yeah.
So I think we might have time for two more questions. One, and you can each take this separately. So again, Keith, you're more of the artistic mind. Evan, you're more of the structural mind. Do either of y'all have inspirations that come to mind?
Oh, yeah. Do you want to go first?
I think this is definitely a question geared towards Keith.
Well, I imagine, I'm sure you have... structural inspirations of some kind, or it could be from your physical background, your physics background.
Inspirations. This is an interesting question. I don't know if I ever thought about this.
Are you just so practical that you look at a place and you're like, "Well, practical. We're gonna solve this problem, this
I'm
problem,
pretty
and this
boringly
problem.
Practical."
He's so practical. It is like shocking that we've made it together this long. It's just unbelievably practical.
It's yin and yang, though. I mean, it's, I know, you're
it
balancing
really
the,
it really in the is. Biggest sense. Like, it is so funny when we buy something to has if it requires assembly, it's like, I'm going to go take a vacation, and he's going to like have the time of his life reading every line of the instruction manual. I'm like, throw the stupid instruction manual away. I know how to do this. This is stupid.
I'm like, well, actually, you don't, Keith.
You know what? We both have the same result, usually.
We should do an IKEA or a furniture put together challenge where we both, I'm not going to use instructions, see who can get it done fastest.
Well, or just who gets it done correctly is the question.
We would judge on different levels. My inspiration comes from, I love art so much. I am not the greatest artist, but I love to think that I am sometimes. I like doing all kinds of art. And that was really the whole thing with the houses, was it was just, again, like a big blank space to do whatever I wanted. And so my inspirations come from the city of Detroit. Like anywhere I'm walking, anybody I'm talking to.
Yeah, actually, like on that's actually kind of a part of the show, is that yeah. every house is themed very differently. And right. it's just kind of like whatever Keith was feeling at that like moment.
Whatever I woke up.
So this house is the Palm House, and this house is, you know,
life is so
well. I remember the Sahara Desert wall.
Okay. Yeah. So you didn't see the pilot. You saw episode one.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just think that's
so that was
fun.
Like the desert mod house, and then that was paired with what was that paired with?
The art gallery house.
Oh yeah, the mid-century museum house. So
it's just like all these rooms of emptiness, and you can just do whatever you want. It's just really fun. But I think my biggest inspiration comes from like David Hockney paintings, and Salvador Dali is my absolute biggest
Keith
inspiration.
Was really into like surrealist.
I love surrealist
art, which comes into play occasionally in the show.
I try to get like I was able to actually still get some original art pieces done during this series somehow. I don't know, but there's a couple that I was really proud of that were really kind of in that surrealist vein, and that was I like. There's a house on the season actually that it's called the Weird House, but it really kind of just takes all of my craziest ideas and puts them all in one house, and it was that was probably...
How much did that break your soul as that was coming together?
It wasn't, I mean, most of it wasn't that bad. There was like maybe one or two things that I was like, I'm not so sure about that, but I mean, it definitely turned out weird. But I mean, it's also
there's a cowboy shrine,
but like, it's also it's like weird. Very fashion. So it's like, you know,
what a compliment, man.
If you're into that sort of thing, then I think you would really like it.
There's just a bunch of fun stuff in that house. And that was, again, it just goes back to, I get really bored, and everybody that I've ever worked with on the design side, at least in the past, wanted the same look. It was like at the time in Denver, it was like farmhouse, everybody wanted farmhouse. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm so bored with this. Like I did one house and I was like, all right, I'm done with that.
How frequently do y'all wear clothing that doesn't have paint all over it?
Well, I don't only probably if we're going somewhere nice, but like
even then it still has
like right now I was like
somewhere.
Working on cabinets, so I'm like, you know,
it's kind of, you know, like people ask us, like our investment group bought us a bunch of clothes because they were like, you know, you have to think about how you present yourself if you're going to have like a lifestyle brand. And I'm like, but this is my lifestyle.
No, I loved it when y'all opened the door and you were wearing these shirts that clearly you've been working in. I was like, this is awesome. These guys are just living the life. It's authentic.
Living some life.
Yeah, like, we thrift most of our clothes, and because clothes are stupid.
But we do know how to get cleaned up.
We can.
If, you know,
I have a business
if
idea
the moment
for you
calls.
Yeah.
So a shirt, you should get a shirt. A clean shirt before you start a new house, and wear that shirt however frequently feels comfortable during the actual home renovation. And then once the renovation is complete, you can sell that shirt or auction it off
for like charity or something,
as like a special item that is nostalgic and has history associated with that house.
Okay. I don't think they're gonna want it ever.
I mean, that's a pretty sweet looking.
It actually became like a thing where I would buy like a new shirt, and it was like a brand new like work shirt, but it was new, and I would wear it to like filming, and then like the director would kind of look at it and be like, is there any way you can like kind of junk it up a little bit? Like none of your other clothes are like this clean. I'm like,
yeah, it was like, it looks like something's off. And we were like, well, just give us like 30 minutes. It'll be covered in just everything.
Okay. So last question. Let me double check. We have time here. Yeah, we got time. One more question. So y'all are this dynamic duo that each have strengths, like, you know, beating a dead horse at this point. But what is something that as y'all are going shoulder to shoulder through the ridiculousness of the, you know, demands of what you do, from just turning the houses to the TV show, all the stress that you described, what's something that you each appreciate in each other? Could be professionally, could be personally, just one thing that comes to mind that makes it all possible.
I would say for me, Keith, he's in certain ways he's better at dealing with the extreme adversity than I am. Like when things really, really get bad, like I can kind of lean on Keith to be like, to sort of like make sure that the job is still like happening, like we don't like completely fall apart in like this moment of, you know, craziness. So I'd say for me, it's, I mean, yeah, you definitely held me together a couple times during the filming of season one.
No, I mean, I always looked at it kind of as it was my dream-ish. When I was a kid, I really wanted a show on HGTV. As I became an adult, I realized that I didn't want to be famous, so that was like kind of a contrary thing. But Evan has always been the most kind person, no matter how terrible things get, no matter how scary something gets, no matter how much you want to just sit and cry all day. Like there are many, many days I would wake up and I was just like, I don't think I can do this today. And he would be there at a high note when I was at a low note, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And that was kind of that balance. That's what we've always talked about with our relationship. It's always been tried to be like a respectful balance. Like we have to find, you know, like there's certain things that he does that I don't really care for, and I'm sure I'm the opposite. But you learn in time, especially in when you're in these kind of unbelievably stressful situations, like all the stupid stuff just fades away. You know, like who put the dishes away suddenly is like, who gives a shit? You know, like we have much bigger things to worry about, and you attack those as a team, and that's the only way you can get through it. So
That's awesome.
I think we did, you know, like,
I'm hoping that season two can be a little bit less crazy.
I really hope so, because I mean, push comes to shove, I know we could do it if it had to be done, but there's, if we're not getting better, then we're not smart.
I mean,
enough
we're
to
always
do this
thinking
shit.
Of ways of, you know, how can we make the process smoother?
Yes.
And, you know.
And that's the case for everything. We try to think about when we go through something stressful, we kind of try to look back and be like, how could that have gone better? And that's, you know, we spend a lot of time reflecting on our mistakes.
Yeah.
Amazing. Keith, Evan, thank you so much. That was really fun.
That was fun. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
Thanks for coming over.
Yeah. I'm hoping that maybe somebody in Durango will call and be like, I have a free house for you.
I can almost guarantee it. I mean, who knows where it'll be from, but
vacation home. Yes.
No. Do y'all have social media accounts? That people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what are those? Cause you will get hit up for sure.
Awesome. Mine is Keith_Bynum, BYNUM.
Mine
for
just
Instagram.
Just search Evan Thomas. And then I'll show up.
Not the historian.
Yeah, there's like this other Evan Thomas who's from like Newsweek who's like way more famous than I am. So
like on the clothing thing, it's really funny. If you check IMBD and look at Bargain Block, there's no pictures of me or Shay, but there's a picture of the wrong Evan Thomas. And it's this very old man. It's just really funny. We keep getting it in screenshots for people. They're like, I think they have the wrong picture for Evan. Or that was a really stressful season.
Yeah. Yeah, my like handle is EMURALIT. Mm-hmm. We can search Evan Thomas and HGT Bargain Block. And
it should pop up.
Yeah.
Wednesdays, 9 yep. Eastern.
Yep.
Check it out. Sweet guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you all very much for listening. And thank you to Zip for being our sponsor today for this episode. I want to tell you about Zip's all new 353 NSW wheel. It has this really wild looking sawtooth pattern on the rim, pretty distinctive looking, but it's not just for looks. There's a whole bunch of benefits here. The one you'll notice first, probably, if you get your hands on a pair of these wheels, is when you pick them up, you just feel how ridiculously light this wheel set is. It's barely over 1,200 grams. That is the lightest wheel set I've ever owned of any discipline. And what's crazy about that is that it's 45 millimeters in rim depth. Usually when you've got extra carbon material like that for aerodynamic purposes, the wheel gets a lot heavier, but not in this case. Other benefits of this sawtooth pattern, crosswind stability is so next level. Anyone that's ridden deeper depth rims like this will know that kind of buffety feeling that you get with crosswind. I'm not exactly sure how it works, but the shape of this rim allows for so much more stability that I was literally able to take my hands off the handlebars on a recent ride just as an experiment while there was some crosswind. You know, no more death gripping your handlebars when it gets windy out there. Really, really awesome. Something else really cool about this wheel set is the internal rim width is quite wide, and they're able to do that by taking out the hooked rim element. That's better for tubeless setup. It's better for running lower pressures. It's actually safer, believe it or not. That's a little bit counterintuitive, but the way the tire interfaces is a lot more solid and safer. There's just loads of benefits about this new wheel. I highly recommend you go check it out. Zip's all new 353 NSW. Thanks so much to Zip for being long-standing supporters of this podcast and of my team, the Orange Tail Off-Road team. Thanks also to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show. I want to give her a quick shout out for the episode last week. As y'all will have heard, we had some pretty rough sound quality. We had this really bad audio file issue, and she really got it as good as we could. Sorry that the sound quality was a little lower than usual. Fortunately, this week we had another in-person interview. Man, I prefer those. I cannot wait until this vaccine continues to take greater hold and we can get back to life as it was before the pandemic and have more in-person interviews. Thanks also to all of y'all for subscribing, leaving a rating, leaving a review. Spread the word. Word of mouth is one of the biggest ways that y'all can help us. We'll catch you next week.